Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Welcome to The Sean Ryan Show, where today we have an insightful interview with a remarkable guest who shares their unique journey from humble beginnings in India to becoming a successful entrepreneur in the tech world. This episode promises to delve into the fascinating implications of quantum computing and its potential impact on global power dynamics, as well as personal stories that shaped our guest's entrepreneurial spirit. Get ready for a captivating discussion that blends technology, personal history, and the drive for innovation. Let's begin.
No, thank you for having me. I'm just really grateful for everything this country has given us.
Me too. But everybody gets a gift.
Amazing.
Vigilously gummy bears made here in the USA, legal in all 50 states. There's no funny business in it. It's just candy. Of course, they probably will be illegal here when RFK gets going because, you know, it's got all the bad shit in them. But
I love it. Thank you.
But they taste good. So, and then one other thing before we get in the weeds, I've got a Patreon account. Patreon, a lot of these guys have been with us since the very beginning when I was doing this thing in my attic. Then we moved here. Wife kicked me out because we had a kid. She's like, get all these people out of the house. And then now we're building a new studio that's going to be about 3.5 times the size of this one. Should be done in about 3 months. You'll have to come back and see it. But one of the things I do is I give them the opportunity to ask each and every guest a question. So this is from Kevin O'Malley. Will the massive capacities of quantum computers influence the balance of power once they're leveraged as offensive tools?
Yes, absolutely. Quantum surprise, staying ahead of it, understanding its implications. One way of thinking about it is there's nothing new under the sun. There's just the OODA loop. And what is quantum's implication on how quickly you're going to go through John Boyd's observe, orient, decide, act OODA loop? I think it has exponential implications on that.
What exactly is quantum computing? I hear it all the time. It sounds scary. I mean, is it just really, really fast? I mean, what is it?
I think that it's really like millions of times faster is the way to think about it. It's like you can compute. It uses quantum mechanics to do the computation, and you're able to compute enormous permutations and combinations of things at incredible speed. The most obvious implication is it breaks all of our legacy encryption. So your ability to communicate securely, and to the extent anyone has been storing historical encrypted communications, their ability to decrypt that,
oh boy,
will be near instantaneous. So it has huge implications there. But then for your ability going forward now, like you're going to have to adopt that so you have quantum proof, quantum encryption that works. But then I think there's even more implications beyond that. The encryption is the first thing that we have to worry about. The next thing is, how are we going to employ this for decision advantage?
How close are we to that?
Well, that's kind of an open question. There, I think really smart people I know keep saying we're really close, but really smart people in the 60s thought we were 10 years away from AI. So we'll have to see.
Who else is working on it in the world?
The Chinese.
Great. Well, we're going to talk a lot about China in the interview too. So, but getting into the interview, I mean, you grew up in a mud hut in India. So
My father did. Yeah. So my father was the last of 9 children in a single, he was born in a single room mud hut in the south of India. And his siblings all helped him get to college, you know, and India had its own version, still does have its own version of DEI there. So he was not allowed, he's a very smart man, but he wasn't allowed to go to med school. He couldn't get a slot, but he became a pharmacist. That's like the next best thing for him. And he was sleeping after he graduated from pharmacy school. He was sleeping literally under the kitchen table of one of his brothers. And his sister-in-law, brother's wife, got kind of tired of having him around the house. So found him a job in Nigeria. He was 23 at the time. And so he, you know, young man, excited about adventure. He went to Nigeria as a pharmacist to build the first pharmaceutical manufacturing facility in all of Africa. Until then, all the drugs were imported. And so he did really well for himself at a very young age. I was probably born 7 years after he'd been living in Nigeria. My mom went back to India to have me. And then I came back to Nigeria as soon as, you know, as soon as I was old enough to travel. So I really, my first 3 or so years of my life, I was in Nigeria. But the reason that came to an end, we had a horrible armed robbery in the house, which we lived across the street from the manufacturing facility where all of the cash was kept from the operation. And so it was a little bit of an inside job of people who worked there who did this. They decapitated the dog. They pistol whipped dad. They threatened to execute him. They threatened my mom. I was a child, and really, I was just excited to have visitors. You know, you can't control a child. I was just excited to have visitors in the middle of the night. Dad was only spared because one of the 5 armed robbers was a regular at, my mom ran an open kitchen. Anyone who worked at the facility, anyone who was help, anyone from the surrounding area, they could always come and eat Indian food that mom would make. And so this guy was a regular, and he just made sure they didn't kill us.
Wow.
And so we left all of our earthly possessions behind and had to find a place to resettle. Dad had a friend who somehow, just, you know, how life works, had moved to LA, a friend that he grew up with in this village, moved to LA, and he was selling knickknacks at theme parks.
He went from pharmaceutical manufacturing to selling knickknacks in the States.
So this friend was like, you know, there's this place, Orlando. I live in LA. There's this place, Orlando. All the theme parks are moving there. I need someone I can trust there. And that's how we ended up in Orlando selling knickknacks to theme parks, which was fantastic. You know, and for me, it was fantastic. My after school care program was really, mom would pick me up from school. We'd go to SeaWorld so she could restock the shelves, and I'd be, you know, petting the stingrays. So I thought that was normal. I didn't quite realize that, you know, what a unique experience it was. Now, there were some downsides to this. You know, some of the knickknacks we sold were T-shirts. And I was, until I was old enough to read, I was dressed in all of the T-shirt misprints. It didn't say Shamu. It would say, like, Tamu. You know, it's like everything that went wrong, that was the free clothes I got to have. But it was also really a privilege to grow up in the shadow of the Space Coast. You know, Orlando's really, it's close enough that in elementary school, you would file out to the courtyard to watch the shuttle launch. You would wake up Saturday mornings to a double sonic boom of the shuttle re-entering. And it gave you a visceral sense of scientific progress, American prosperity, what we can do collectively when we put our mind to it.
Wow. Well, what kind of stuff were you, I mean, your dad's your hero, correct?
He is my hero, yeah.
Is he still with us today?
He passed away in 21.
I'm sorry to hear that. Sorry to hear that. So you grew up, I mean, you're an entrepreneur. When did the entrepreneurial mindset kind of kick in for you?
At a pretty early age, because my dad, in some sense, you could say, was also an entrepreneur, and he was always
definitely
encouraging me to think about these things. And I worked at his pharmacy in Orlando as a child in high school. I started programming 11th grade. I started programming professionally. And kept doing that. I actually dropped out of Cornell for a hot minute there to build a company and try to get going with it. But I've always been dabbling in these sorts of efforts. And I knew that ultimately I wanted to be part of creating something new, you know, being part of an early founding team. And really, the reason I went from Cornell to Stanford in 2003 can be hard to remember, but even Google didn't recruit on the Cornell campus. Most of my technical classmates, unfortunately, went into consulting and banking. You know, there's nothing wrong with it, but it's not the same thing as creating.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to find some way, some mechanism to get to the West Coast to be with a bunch of other people who really thought of building as the primary purpose of their life's mission. So within 2 months of being at Stanford, I had a full-time job as the 5th employee at a startup called Zoom with an X. That did international money transfer. It was seed funded by Peter Thiel. And my interviews were with Roelof Botha and Keith Raboy, who are founding members of the PayPal Mafia. And that's how I kind of got started in that world.
Man, it seems like all you guys know each other pretty well. You and how did you meet Joe?
So I had been working at Zoom for almost 3 years, and one of the colleagues I was working with said, you know, there's this company that just sounds perfect for you.
As we shift gears from the fascinating world of quantum computing and its implications, let's dive into the personal journey that shaped our guests' entrepreneurial spirit and the unique experiences that fueled their drive for innovation.
And that's what happened. We just drove all our stuff over there, flew over. For 2 weeks, the crusty Warren officers were like, why do I have to find housing for these 22-year-olds? You know, 2 weeks. But after that, we earned our keep. They're like, I know why they're here.
You were over there?
I didn't go on that trip, but Matt Grimm, who is one of the co-founders of Anduril, was working for me at the time. He went over on that trip. Greg Barbaccia, who's now the federal government CIO, he was one of their first guys on the ground in Balad.
But you've been over there.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
It was eye-opening. I mean, most of my time I spent at Leatherneck, so in Helmand, working with the Marines.
Nice place.
Yeah,
I've been there.
Dicey spot.
But what year?
That was 2011.
No shit. I was there around that time. Interesting. Tell me about it. How did that experience go for you?
I mean, we would have these, it's like a cup of motivation undersells it. It's like a water tank of motivation. You know, you have these people, they come back from mission, they tell you what happened, they tell you their ideas, their feature requests, and you just have unbounded energy to code right there. You're just in a plywood little setup writing code, and okay, I'm going to have something better for you for tomorrow. And you just do that again and again. That the whole product development lifecycle. That was really, I was the first forward deployed engineer at Palantir, which investors hated because they thought it was a service business, not how you're supposed to do software. Everything about it was wrong to them. But it was so clearly right for our users. You know, of course you need the person who actually knows how to build the product sitting forward in the tent with the people doing the work so that you can observe not what people in headquarters think the software needs to be, but the empirical reality on the front of what is missing, what could make this person more successful on the next mission than the prior mission. And if you do that for long enough, you just build this deep understanding of everything that's broken in the world, everything that sucks about their experience, everything that makes them more likely to come back as a team together. And it's also, by the way, how you say, you know, there's lots of jobs coders can take. But, you know, it is an addiction to the motivation. You know, your sense of purpose is unbounded.
Man, I love that way of thinking. I mean, I think like that just doing the podcast, which, you know, I find whatever sector I'm operating in, business, military, I mean, there's always this box that they want you to think inside of. And people say, well, think outside of the box. I think, what box? There is no box to think of. And so I'm always looking for ways to innovate this and to not go by the typical roadmap that everybody expects you and wants you to follow. And you guys, like, nailed it.
You know, to take credit away from us and give it to our customers, I think, you know, first of all, this kernel is absorbing a lot of risk by kind of bending some, I wouldn't say breaking, but bending some rules and going against the system. And that was the beginning of a much longer fight. As that became successful, more and more people, you know, the first thing they do when they would deploy would put in an urgent operational need statement to get Palantir because what they had wasn't working. And, you know, some of those people did suffer career consequences for doing the right thing and doing that. And you knew you had to deliver for them. But the other part of it is really without their partnership. It's like the good ideas don't come eating strawberries in Palo Alto, right? They come on the fire cells of Djibouti and the factory floor of Detroit where you can see firsthand what's happening and not. And that's all of the inspiration, all of the creativity. It comes from that environment. And, you know, I think now this methodology has become more commonplace. People talk about forward deployed engineering. Companies are building around it. And I think it's great because I would say a critique of the software industrial complex is, if software is so great, why does nothing seem to work? Why are doors falling off planes? Why is there so much fraud in our government system? Like, we should be looking really hard at this. And I think it's because we've just been doing it wrong. We haven't been holding ourselves accountable to the primacy of winning. It doesn't matter what box of software you thought you were going to make. Everyone living inside that box, does it work? Does it matter? What could you change so that it worked better tomorrow? You know, and are you impatient enough to go drive that change? And a lot of that comes down to institutionalizing rebellion. You know, there was nothing that headquarters was going to tell our engineers in the field that would make them better at coming up with the next feature. Like that was going to come out of their own crazy creative ideas being really right next to the problem. So my job is to support them in doing that to the greatest extent possible as we continue to build the company. So the machine doesn't crush them, the machine encourages them. And that's led to this philosophy at Palantir that we are not a factory, we're an artist colony. Like my job is to find Dali and Monet and don't do stupid things like yell at Monet to paint more like Dali. Like each of these people are unique artists. And my job is to get out of their way, make sure other people stay out of their way, provide as much room as possible, and help them, you know, just like an artist. It's not like every piece of art is better than the last one. You go through waves and cycles and just create the environment that allows them to do their best work.
Interesting. You guys, Palantir sued the government towards the beginning, correct?
Yeah. In 2016, we sued the Army because we were unable to compete on their Army Intel program. So the story is like all these units, as they would deploy, they would request Palantir. The reason they had to request Palantir is there was an Army program of record, as the government calls it, called DSIGS. And D6A was, you know, it was the blessed system that was supposed to do Army Intel, except it didn't really work. $26 billion, many years of development. And you would honestly find it, you know, when the generals came, people would turn it on and pretend like it worked, but it was a paperweight to them. They would just, you know, store, it was just sitting there collecting dust. And we were there on the ground. We were highly responsive. And all we wanted was the opportunity. So this program was coming up for a recompete, and we wanted to compete to win it. The way the Army structured it precluded us from competing. It basically said, you have to custom build a product and turn over all your IP to us, or you're not even allowed to compete, which is illegal, it turns out, which is why we sued. That there's a law from 1994 called the commercial item preference, that if a commercial product exists, the government is not allowed to go custom develop something because that's risky, probably going to cost you a lot more. And as a philosophy, we'd rather tie our investments to things the commercial world has adopted because it means, you know, it probably works. It's been de-risked. The hyper-competitive free markets are voting on and providing the stimulus to keep making it better. And it's going to be cheaper. So we sued them. It went to appeal. We won on appeal. So it's a very, very strong precedent. But I think the key lesson from that really is like how hard it is to change just the momentum in the bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite anecdotes is there was a contractor working on this legacy D6A system in his civilian job, but he was a reservist. He got flipped to active duty and deployed to Afghanistan. The first thing he did when he hit the ground was put in an ONS for Palantir. So when his life was on the line, he knew what he wanted to back.
Wow. Wow. What are some other, I mean, how often were you guys going overseas?
Constantly.
Working with the warfighters?
Yeah, constantly. Like we were in Iraq and Afghanistan throughout the conflict, supporting users. We were working with coalition as well, with UK Special Forces, other places, Philippines, Djibouti, supporting, you know, ODAs. We get on the little, I don't know what you'd call it, the conveyor belt of flights that would go visit the forward operating bases and make sure folks had what they needed, make sure that their forward lock, like they would take their laptops to do key leader engagements where like all of the intel was really coming back. And when you're alone and unafraid and disconnected, like this was your brain. This is how you were coordinating things. A lot of the value was doing our part. You know, you can't do it all, but doing our part to change that the nature of the conflict from being 17 one-year-long wars to really creating continuity. Like some of the, you know, you'll have Marines who tell you, like, there are Marines alive today because of the simple fact that we could look back at past deployments and realize every time prior teams landed at this HLZ, they got bombed to shit. You know, it was always an ambush.
As we shift our focus from the innovative strategies on the ground to the broader implications for our military and industrial capabilities, let's explore how these lessons are shaping the future of warfare.
You know, these cheap explosive munition drones that were guidable with a Starlink. It's an entirely different conception of the problem that I think a big surface navy would have could get there eventually, but it's not going to get there as quickly or as dynamically. That's one lesson. The second one is we should have realized we had a 5-alarm fire when we went through 10 years of 155 production in 10 weeks. And, you know, I think in World War II, we used to make like 500,000 shells a month. And now we're struggling to make roughly one-tenth that, 65,000 or so. You know, and we've had some time. Ukraine didn't happen last week. We've had some time. So what lessons can we take about what it's going to take to actually ramp up the industrial base as a consequence? And the lesson from that is that we got it wrong. We thought the stockpile was the deterrent. If we could go to our adversaries and say, look at how much stuff we have sitting on the stock, they'd be scared. It's not. The deterrent is your ability to produce the stockpile.
How fast you can make them.
Yeah. And so we should never have cut down to minimum rate production. All these ideas that were really born out of an economic fantasy that we could spend way less and still have as much security. Look, I think it's reasonable for a democracy to debate, like, how much do we want to spend? But to believe you're not trading off security, like, we have to just account for all the trade-offs appropriately. And I think if we all understood, like, actually we're going to change our spending profile and it's going to mean that we're much less secure, we may have made different decisions along the way. So we shouldn't, you know, that is a hard-earned lesson that the production, not the stockpile, is a deterrent. We shouldn't forget it. And it should shape everything. That's why you need something like an Anduril. You need to be able to make 10,000 of these things, not 100. And when you think in your mind, oh, I'm only going to need 100, you start having all the bells and whistles. Like, how do we make this thing super exquisite, super fancy? It needs to do all these things. And I'm only going to have a few of them. So let's make it like a Swiss Army knife that can do everything. And then it turns out it takes 8 years to build one of them. And they're ungodly expensive. And then in the moment of need, you realize, I actually need 10,000 of these. And so when you start realizing those trade-offs, like, how can we cut production time down to one-fifth? Like, it should take 20% as long to build these things. They should be affordable so we can be able to build 100 times as many as we would historically have built. And now we're back to deterrent.
Palantir is down in, you guys are working with the border too, right? Down
that's right.
Border. What are you guys doing down there?
Yeah, so the work like that 10th Mountain is doing out of Fort Huachuca, the work that NORAD NORTHCOM does and supporting border operations, SOUTHCOM. So all of that is our MAVEN, our AI-driven operating system for the Defense Department. In addition to that, you know, we have a longstanding relationship with ICE, which actually started in 2011 when, I think it was 2011, maybe 2010, when Jaime Zapata was assassinated in Mexico. He was an ICE agent, young 32-year-old American. And we surged in to help them after. We had been talking to the point of bureaucracy and these crises providing clarity. We had been talking to ICE for 12 months before that about starting to work with them. We were stuck in the bureaucracy of how does one procure these things? How does one buy these things? After that assassination, we got a call from one of the field agents. We were up and running in 11 hours.
Wow.
And we were a big part of responding to Operation Fallen Hero, is what that's called, and a longstanding relationship with them born out of doing right by these service members after that. And now I think there's a much bigger role. There's of course border, there's immigration. These are two sides. A lot has happened. I think, you know, a lot has improved on the border. We've gone down from roughly in the prior administration 2,000 getaways a day to less than 80 a day now. So that border is getting sealed. And I think the bulk of the effort will turn to an immigration problem of how do we manage the illegals who are here and the deportation operations around that?
What do you think we should do about that?
Well, I think we're starting in the right place. Anyone who is a violent offender.
Yeah.
It's hard to understand. I saw a clip from JD that I thought was pretty good, which is it's hard to even understand what's on the other side of this. So why should we not be deporting gang members, violent offenders, people who have committed crimes who have no right to be here? How is that in the interest of the American people? Now, I think it's a large-scale operation, just given what's actually happened here. Like, how are we going to do it? You know, if you think the numbers are between 10 and 20 million illegals, there's a question of how you actually are going to do that. How much treasure can you spend? How do you do this as efficiently as possible? And so I think starting with precise information that actually borrows a lot of the lessons that we have from the commercial side, you know, it's a value chain optimization. You know, okay, where do I have detention capacity? Where do I have logistics on flights? Like, how do I do this as efficiently as possible in a way that provides the most incremental lift to the American people? And I think that clearly starts with violent offenders and areas that matter.
What's working down there? I mean, getting into the nitty gritty down on the border. I mean, how was it? How did we seal it off so fast?
I think a lot of it is, I shouldn't say a lot. First, it's important that people realize we're taking the border seriously. That alone is a deterrent effect to trying to cross the border. So what do you think is going to happen on the other side? If the subtle messaging was nothing, actually just come, like you basically have an open border. So now like, it's going to be really hard for you when you're on this side here, and you should be really worried that you might be deported at any single moment. It's like, well, maybe I shouldn't come. So that's one step. Two, I think designating the cartels, or there's a supply chain behind helping people get here, designating them as terrorist organizations has changed the calculus as well. It's kind of changed the economics for the bad actors and what they want to be involved with. So I think it's probably overdetermined, like there's a number of factors, but I wouldn't underestimate how important it is that people realize like we're serious about this as a precondition.
Let's take a quick break.
Sure.
When we come back, I want to talk about the future of warfare.
Okay.
You sign up for something, forget about it after the trial ends, then you're charged month after month after month. The subscriptions are there, but you're not using them. 85% of people have at least one paid subscription going unused every month. Thanks to Rocket Money, I can see all my subscriptions in one place and cancel the ones I'm not using anymore. And now I'm saving more money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Rocket Money's dashboard gives you a clear view of your expenses across all of your accounts and keeps you informed with alerts if bills increase in price, there's unusual spending activity, or if you're close to going over budget. Rocket Money will even automatically scan your bills to find opportunities to save and lower your bills. Then you can ask them to negotiate for you. They'll deal with customer service so you don't have to. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions and reach your financial goals faster with Rocket Money. Go to rocketmoney.com/SRS today. That's rocketmoney.com/SRS. rocketmoney.com/SRS. I'm always on the lookout for ways to get healthier, especially now. That's why I'm so glad I discovered Armora Colostrum. Armora Colostrum has thousands of people reporting absolutely life-changing benefits, tens of thousands of five-star reviews, and transformational stories. Armora Colostrum is a proprietary concentrate of bovine colostrum that harnesses over 400 living bioactive nutrients that can help strengthen the barriers of your body and help fuel cellular health for thousands of research-backed health benefits. Armora Colostrum can help strengthen immunity and gut health, help improve fitness and metabolism, and enhance skin and hair radiance. We've worked out a special offer for my audience. Receive 15% off your first order. Go to tryarmora.com/SRS or enter SRS to get 15% off your first order. That's tryarmora.com/SRS. These statements and products have not been evaluated by the FDA. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or condition.
But the big machine loses that qualitative sense. And so I think that's going to be really important. When I think about the most important projects we've been involved with, there are really a handful of commanders who were so insightful. I think they might be offended to hear me describe them this way, but they are what we would call in Silicon Valley product managers. They are the people with the vision of what they need the software to do so that they can accomplish this thing in the world. And they would not see it as below them. They three-star, four-star generals, they would not see it as below them to sit there and critique your mocks of and tell you these pixels are wrong. I need it to be like this, because they recognize that what they're getting is an Iron Man suit, a software Iron Man suit that allows them to control the battle space. It's got to fit them perfectly. It's got to fit their mind. They are in this context, founder personalities, right? And as a consequence, they can get so much done. And I think so much goes wrong when you're trying to think about your software solution independent of the human who's going to be wielding it and operating, the principal, the founder.
You know, I understand all that, but what I want to dive into as well is, I mean, with all these new autonomous vehicles, and like I said, when I talked to Palmer, he was talking about basically putting an AI brain in a lot of the stuff that we already use, tanks, planes, subs, all that kind of stuff. And so, I mean, just for a tank, for example, don't know a lot about tanks, but I mean, I would imagine, I think it takes what, probably 3 to 5 people to operate one. And so when we put these AI brains in all of these vehicles and turn them into autonomous vehicles, I mean, how much of the military personnel is that going to cut out?
I think it's one example of it'll cut out. It'll make you a much smaller, leaner fighting force, mm-hmm. for sure. So let's just call it half. You can get, you know, you can probably make everything half as big and as lethal or more lethal than before. There's so many things with tanks. Like, how do you clear the range of fire? You know, the commander has to pop their head up. They have to somehow get on a phone and tell the other tanks, like, when the soldiers are dismounting, you don't want to be in the field of fire. You know, that should all be software. No one should be picking up a phone. The tank should be able to communicate to the other tanks. And it's just like, that's just, so once you start like unpacking the layers of how many things we're just covering down with human labor, you start to realize like, oh, this stuff's going to go away. And in fact, the humans are doing it slow. We're doing it at the speed that humans can do it. Mm-hmm. And we make mistakes when we're doing it. And it has a huge training burden to do it. So how long does it take to even ramp people up changes. So I think it's going to be a pretty dramatic impact. You have to earn it, though. You know, you have to kind of ship these innovations to the operating fighting force, and no one will be faster to adopt this than the fighting force. It makes them more survivable, more lethal. There's one project we did at NTC at Fort Irwin. The division was roaming around the desert. You know, division, big army formation, but using the latest technology, just like this, they were able to get their division footprint down to 26 people. So instead of the normal 400 plus people, wow. You need a big jock, big screens, which means the enemy can see you. You're pretty immobile. You're not going to be survivable. You're going to be blown to smithereens. 26 people, the red team could not find them in the desert.
No kidding. You know, I don't want to come across like I think that's a bad thing. I mean, I don't want my kids going to war. I've been there, and I don't want them to have to do that. And so, I mean, I think it's a good thing. I'm just trying to wrap my head around, you know, I mean, I think there's 450,000 active duty in the Army. I don't know how many of them are warfighters, but I mean, would you need anybody in any of these vehicles?
Well, you definitely want first contact to be made by entities that have no blood in their system, right? Mm-hmm. Like the front line of troops, but there's also the front line of robots, and that should be further front. Mm-hmm. And we need to be thinking about how we have less risk to force as a consequence and have, you know, improved mission outcomes by doing this. I do think, though, that the tail is where the immense opportunity is. So if you tooth the tail here, so yes, it's going to make the tooth sharper and you're going to need fewer teeth, but the tail is enormous. You have more people in the acquisition corps than you do in the Marine Corps. And the human processes that we use to support all of this, it's both very latent and slow. It obfuscates indirectly just because humans are touching and massaging the data, like what's actually going on. And we need to integrate that. When I think about the most important missing strategic asset to the US government from a deterrence perspective, it is an integrated view from the factory floor to the foxhole. And by that, I really mean, let's articulate the threats we care about under the timelines we create. These are the foxhole scenarios that matter to us. This is the national defense strategy. This is who we're trying to deter and when. And work that backwards to, based on what I'm spending and building, does any of that stuff matter? Will it be there in time? You know, and I think the Department of Defense is the only institution I know of that has divided up supply and demand. You know, the process of integrating supply and demand is usually the beating heart of a commercial company. This sales and operation planning process, people have different names for it. In the department, we ask the services to go build things. That's the supply side. And we ask the combatant commanders to do the war fighting. That's the demand side. They have to respond to real world events. They don't really get that much of a vote in terms of what's happening here. We have a lot of control over what's happening here. We have ideas about the scenarios in the world we care about making sure don't happen. How do we integrate these things so that we understand, like, you know what? It actually would be better to buy a less capable weapon system we can make 7 times faster at a lower price point because the other stuff's not going to be ready in a time that's relevant to anyone. Right? It's just running headless by doing this. Mm-hmm. Now, and I think if you had that, it becomes the first way you can have meaningful conversations like, yes, I know there are jobs in your district, but do you understand how you're actually going to sacrifice American prosperity? We are going to lose over 100 jobs in your district. And I think that becomes, now you've changed, turned the tables on what is politically survivable.
With Palantir, you guys aren't only in software. You also have vehicles you're making, the Titan, Tenebris. I mean, could you go into those a little bit?
Yeah, the Titan truck is a satellite ground station on wheel that's really wheels that's really about enabling long-range precision fires. So how can we do deep sensing of the battle space to enable precision fires of the enemy deep in their territory? What I think is really cool about the Titan program is that we were the first software company to win as a prime contractor. Now, it is a physical thing. We still don't think of ourselves as a hardware company. We've built a team of super friends, of power horses, Anduril, Northrop Grumman, L3 Harris, Sierra Nevada. They're helping us build this thing. But what makes, you know, the truck in some sense is a commodity. What's in the shelter is what's doing the AI that's finding the enemy on the battle space using national technical means, using satellite communications, doing the processing, exploitation, and dissemination on board of this with a two-man crew, so very, very efficient, and enabling then the transmission to the gun line to actually go destroy and close with the enemy. And building this around the software first. What does the software need to do? That is our lethal capability. Then how do I make it as amazing for the warfighter as possible as a consequence? Rather than doing what we've done backwards so many times is we have this hardware platform and then we're constrained by what software can we put in there. And it's not good enough and it's not adaptable and there's not enough compute. You kind of designed it backwards. And this is one of the paradoxes. So if you're a true historical hardware company, you know, you can think about it like building a house. If you're building a house, you got to build the foundation first. You are entirely limited by the foundation. Software is not like that. With software, you got to build the kitchen first, and you build the rest of the house around the main thing. And now we're starting to see that culture enter into defense. That's what Tesla does, right? That's what SpaceX. So in defense, we're starting to see that happen where people are taking very sophisticated, the next generation of platforms, and they're starting with the software-first approach. What does this platform need to do? What are the threats? What do I need to be able to sense? What do I need to be able to affect? Can I even build that compute first, which by the way goes pretty quickly? That you can measure that in months, not years, not certainly not decades. Once I get that right, now I have the constraints around what I can build my airframe or my land vehicle or my submersible around, because I know it can accomplish the essential mission that I need and has the capabilities to do it. And you don't end up in these situations like with the frigate, where you buy the frigate, you make a bunch of changes along the way, and you realize it won't float. You know, it's like the whole thing is, who decided that was the requirement? You know, how realistic is that as the end scenario? So what you get is an overly heavy helmet that is not comfortable and doesn't work and probably costs a lot as missions happen. So this requirements process is divorced from the actual application. And I think we need to just remember this requirements process is an approximation of what we think we need. The only thing that matters is winning. So can we work backwards from what it is that is actually winning? And where the requirements get in the way, recognize that was a suggestion. You know, get rid of that shit. Don't be so wedded to the playbook that you don't have the common sense God gave a goat. You know, when you need to bend the rule to do the right thing, you got to do that. We've wrapped ourselves up around this stuff, and it leads to all sorts of programs that have met all the requirements and are irrelevant. We spend all sorts of national treasure on doing that. You know, this is where I feel like if you integrate the person is the program. You know, Hyman Rickover could decide his own requirements as he's building the sub. Gene Kranz could change what he thought he needed for Apollo as getting done. Or John Boyd on the F-16. Like, the original requirements document for the F-16 was 7 pages. That's how condensed and, you know, as Mark Twain has that quote, "I didn't have time to write you a short letter, so I wrote you a long one." When you get these 2,000-page requirements document, almost rebuttably, you should think this is crap. Mm-hmm. You know, why is this going to work? No one's had the clarity of thought of what we really need and what's essential to getting this done.
You know, I love that you are going to Bragg and it sounds like you guys are kind of integrating in all over the place. I wish I would have had that when I was in, you know, where we could just articulate what we needed and what we wanted and somebody like you guys could implement it and get it back to us. And And how open is, I mean, I don't know if you guys are dealing, I'm sure you are, how open is Secretary Hegseth to making that happen?
Incredibly open. I mean, I think he, to the point of common sense, like this is a common sense administration. They completely recognize the value of dual purpose companies. People are putting their own capital at risk to build things. And, you know, if the customer doesn't like it, guess what? You're out your capital. You know, that's a you problem. Like, but yeah, that's how American industry works. You show up, you invest, you build things, you lean in, you have conviction. And I think the new team completely understands the value of a commercial first approach, understands the value of speed. We don't have time to lose. The idea that things should get cheaper over time, not more expensive over time. It's an opportunity to reimagine the industrial base. And I think there's a tremendous amount of support.
Are you guys integrating in with law enforcement at all?
Maybe on the border. Law enforcement is not a market that we've historically focused on, just given how many there are. But I think Make America Safe Again is a huge priority. So Justice Department, so federal law enforcement will be a focus for us as we turn to the next kind of couple years here. Probably not state and locals.
Well, Shyam, I think that pretty much wraps us up, unless there's anything I'm missing.
No, I think we covered everything. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you. I really appreciate you coming. It's
a ton of fun.
Fascinating. So, thank
you. Yeah, absolutely.
No matter where you're watching Sean Ryan Show from, if you get anything out of this, please like, comment, subscribe, and most importantly, share this everywhere you possibly can. And if you're feeling extra generous, please leave us a review on Apple and Spotify podcasts.